Good afternoon and welcome to the National Press Club. I'm Mick Rood, a member of our Board of Governors and editor of Pharmaceutical and Biotech Daily, a King Publishing Group newsletter. I'd like to welcome club members and their guests here in the room today, as well as those of you who are watching on C-SPAN or listening on National Public Radio or accessing it from the Global Internet Computer News Network. Before introducing our head table, I'd like to remind our members of some upcoming speakers. On Wednesday, May 18th, and Thursday, the 19th, the club is sponsoring a conference entitled Openness and Secrecy, a symposium on establishing accountability in the nuclear age. Our luncheon speaker on Wednesday will be former Interior Secretary Stuart Udall. And on Thursday, the speaker will be the Director of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, John Hollum. And on Thursday, May 26th, Cardinal Joseph Bernardin, the Archbishop of the Archbishop of Chicago, will speak on healthcare reform, the consistent ethic of life. Transcripts and audio and videotapes of this luncheon are available by calling 1-800-500-9911. If you have any questions, and I certainly hope you do, please write them on the cards that are provided at your tables and pass them up to me. I'll answer as many as time permits. Now I'd like to introduce our head table guests and ask them to stand briefly when their names are called. Please withhold your applause until all names have been read. From your right, Francis Murphy, publisher, Washington Afro-American. Rodney Brooks, USA Today. Charlotte Grimes, St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Andrew Mollison, Cox Newspapers, and a former president of this club. Avis Lavelle, Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs at the Department of Health and Human Services, and I should say a former reporter. Christy Wise, freelance journalist and chairwoman of the club's luncheon committee. Ann Sims, acting director of public affairs, Centers for Disease Control. Gerald Jackson, a member of the National Press Club Speakers Committee who arranged today's luncheon. Mary Lou Foy, The Washington Post. Chris Castile, Daily Oklahoman. Deborah Barfield, Knight Ridder Newspapers. And finally, Margaret Eastman, Medical Publishing Enterprises. I'd also like to thank staff members Melissa Bender, Sherry Burton, Melanie Abdo-Dermott, and Jeff Tarbell for working on this luncheon. And now to our speaker. He was only 2 years old, but he remembers clearly lying in bed, sick with pain, laboring heavily to take every breath the whooping cough was stealing from his tiny body. It was 1943 on his parents' farm in rural Anniston, Alabama. The only black doctor locally gave the little boy just 1 week to live. But his mother was able to save his life with a brand of ingenuity unique to generations of black Southern mothers. By the time he had turned 8, young David Satcher was dreaming of becoming Anniston's family doctor. Although Dr. Satcher has never practiced in Anniston, he has spent most of his career training countless numbers of young men and women in family medicine. He is one of the nation's preeminent experts in minority and community health issues. And with a distinguished career of epidemiology, disease, and research, and academic medicine to his credit, the dream gets bigger as he takes over as director of the nation's premier epidemiological organization, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Since 1946, the CDC has played a major role in tracking and preventing the spread of once fatal diseases, including polio, smallpox, tuberculosis, and whooping cough. Dr. Satcher brings to CDC a new agenda, however, targeting the nation's rising wave of violence as a public health issue, as a behavior-based epidemic that kills and injures as certainly as diseases of the flesh. In doing so, researchers can identify risk factors and structure prevention programs. Dr. Satcher graduated from Morehouse College in 1963 and received his MD and PhD from Case Western Reserve University in 1970. Soon after, he became director of the King Drew Sickle Cell Center in Los Angeles. Dr. Satcher has most recently been president of Nashville's Meharry Medical College and CEO of the Meharry Hubbard Hospital. He has received many, many honors for his services in medicine. He's been widely published. He is no Joycelyn Elders, but his message compels us to listen.
Thank you very much, Mick. I appreciate that introduction. That's the first time anybody has ever introduced me as being no Joycelyn Elders, so I have to think about that. But I'm pleased to be put into any sentence with Joycelyn Elders, so I appreciate it anyway. I'm delighted to be with you. I realize the significance of this forum when it comes to presenting ideas, not only for this group of people, but for the nation and the world. And I am honored to be here today and bring you greetings from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta. I'm here to talk about our most priceless resource, our youth, who are in today's society, which is sometimes reckless and violent, if not an endangered species, certainly in danger. Children are at risk even before birth today, when parents and the developing fetus are vulnerable to exposure to environmental toxicants and disease, which result in the birth each year of over 120,000 infants with birth defects. And then the problem continues. In the early years, when 14 million children in daycare are at significant risk of disease, and only one-third of our children are being immunized by the age of 2. Many of them are victims of poor nutrition, neglect, and abuse at home. And then as they move to school age and adolescence, children and young people are placed in profound jeopardy by just a few preventable high-risk behavior patterns formed in youth and often continuing into maturity. These behaviors too often result in death and disability, and at best, a lifetime of underachievement. Perhaps never before in our history have young people been faced with so many deadly choices and exposed to so many dangers over which they have little or no choice. To protect them from both is our obligation in the name of humanity, and it's also our opportunity in the name of good sense. The future of this country, and to some extent the world, will in a few decades be in the hands of over 67 million young people who are now between the ages of 0 and 18 living in the United States. Their survival and their sound health then becomes one of the nation's most vital investments for tomorrow. Now, I want you to understand that my purpose for being here today is not just to talk about how bad things are, but to talk about what I think is also the hope in terms of what we can do as a nation to improve the plight of youth. I happen to agree with John Gardner, a former Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare at the time, who said that life is full of golden opportunities carefully disguised as irresolvable problems. And I think amidst all of the challenges that we face, we do, in fact, have some golden opportunities. In December, I attended the 8th International AIDS Conference for the continent of Africa, and it was held in Morocco. For the first time in these 8 years, they brought to this conference teenagers from throughout Africa, because obviously the role of teenagers in the spread of AIDS is significant. The teenagers set up tents across the street from the hotel where the conference was being held. And when they found out that the director of the CDC was attending the meeting, they insisted on having a roundtable discussion with me. So we got together for a roundtable discussion. And in this discussion, the teenagers asked me many questions about AIDS, about CDC's role and CDC's commitment, and about this nation's commitment to AIDS as a global problem. As I listened to these teenagers from throughout Africa, I noticed something about them, and that was that they reminded me of teenagers in this country. So I decided to ask them a question. And that question was, why is it that seemingly teenagers today engage in such high-risk behaviors? I asked about smoking, about violence, about sexual behaviors. And one young man from Southern Africa said to me, Dr. Satchew, have you ever heard that in Africa it takes a whole village, a whole community to raise a child? And I said, yes, I've heard that. So he said, where is our village? Where is our community? Where are the people who care about children? Not just their own children, but all children. Where are the people who care about the environment? And as I listened, I could imagine teenagers in this country asking the very same question. Where is our community? Where are the people who care about guns coming into communities, about drugs invading communities? Where is our community? And I think the way we answer that question is really key to the future of this country and what's going to happen to our young people. The challenges facing our youth today are vastly different from those of past decades. Advances in vaccines and medication have made enormous strides in reducing the threats of some infectious diseases. Today, the health of young people and adults becomes critically related to the decisions they make about behavior, health-related behaviors. Perhaps the most written about and perhaps the most controversial and complex is sexual behavior. Here are a few of the facts as gathered by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Among 9th to 12th grade students, 54% are sexually active. By the time they reach the 9th grade, and certainly between the 9th and the 12th grade, from 19 to 25% of them have as many as 4 different sex partners. Only 46% of those who are sexually active used a condom during their last sexual contact. Now, what are some of the consequences of these behaviors? About 1 million teenagers a year become pregnant. 5 out of 6 pregnancies among 15 to 19-year-olds are unplanned. And every year, 3 million teenagers are infected with sexually transmitted diseases. 3 million. In fact, 86% of all sexually transmitted diseases occur between the ages of 15 and 29 years of age. But where is our community? Well, in some ways, we're busy fighting against sex education in the schools and against making condoms available to people who are sexually active. The number of AIDS cases among adolescents and young adults increases dramatically each year and is likely more disturbing than the figures show at a glance. Most of the growing numbers of persons diagnosed with AIDS in their mid to late 20s, because of the long incubation period for AIDS, were likely infected as younger adolescents. AIDS is a clear example of the impact of deadly choices made by today's youth. We can't go back in history in recent years and think of another disease for which we didn't have a vaccine and we didn't have a cure. We didn't have a treatment, a viable treatment. So AIDS is a real challenge, and it represents a deadly choice for our young people. But death and disability are only the most dramatic of the results of high-risk sexual behavior among young people. The other issue is the cycle of underachievement and poverty reaching into the next generation. And that may well be the most grievous heritage of all. Children having children as a result, receiving inadequate education and training, being trapped in unskilled employment or no employment, all combine to keep these young people in a revolving door of despair with no way out and with no way into a better life for themselves and their children. This cycle of underachievement may be the most devastating problem. Now, while sexual behavior may receive a large share of our attention and concern, it is by no means the only threat to our youth. Tobacco use is the single most preventable cause of death in this country today. Every year, about 420,000 people die from the results of smoking. And approximately 86% of those smokers become smokers before the age of 18. Despite notable, even spectacular decreases in the overall number of smokers in this country, from like 43% of the population in 1964 to about 25% today. Despite that progress, the number of young people smoking is alarming. Every day in this country, 3,000 new teenagers become smokers. And because smoking is an addictive behavior, smoking in adolescence leads to lifelong health hazards. A national school-based youth risk assessment survey done by CDC in 1991 showed that more than one quarter of all students between ages of the ninth grade and the 12th reported tobacco use in the 30 days prior to the survey. The percentage increased from 23% in the ninth grade to 30% in the 12th grade. So the use of tobacco is now, in this country, a major problem among our youth. The fact is that smoking is a proven health hazard, likely to limit the life expectancy and the productivity of those young people who choose to smoke, thus presenting another deadly choice faced by today's youngsters. A choice, by the way, that's aided and abetted by easy access, by targeted advertising, and a relatively low cost of tobacco products. A recent study in Harlem was presented to me when I was at the Harlem Hospital 2 weeks ago, visiting a prevention center which CDC funds between Columbia and Harlem Hospital. And basically, they told me about a study in which they sent teenagers out into the community where it was illegal to sell tobacco to teenagers, either in packs or loose. And they sent a group of teenagers out into the community to determine if they could purchase tobacco. And what they found was that more than 80% of the time, teenagers were able to purchase tobacco either in the pack or loose, looses as they call them. So there is almost a conspiracy. And it does lead you to wonder, where is our community? Now, as you know, injury is the chief cause of death and disability for our young people, and too many of those disabilities and fatal injuries are caused by unwise behavioral choices. And they include not wearing seat belts or not using a bicycle helmet that is effective more than 85% of the time. Those choices made by young people and adults constitute deadly choices for many people. In fact, when the question was asked, only one out of four students in grades 9 through 12 said that they always use seat belts, and 10% said they never use seat belts. So somewhere in there, 65% of them use them occasionally. It's like, you know, Russian roulette. But it's a serious problem in terms of death and disability and cost of care in the emergency rooms. The use of alcohol and drugs, other drugs, is associated with the leading causes of death and injury, motor vehicle accidents, homicides, suicides, among both teenagers and young adults. The figures here are also alarming because between the grades of 9 and 12, 82% have used alcohol, 31% have used marijuana, and even 6%, 500,000 young people have tried cocaine, and half of them are regular users. As with other perilous choices, the choices of using drugs and alcohol confronting our young people today are not the remote dangers we once knew them to be. Today, they are often no further away than the schoolyard, the neighborhood playground, the streets where we live. Violence at school and at home and on the streets finds some of our children as both victims and perpetrators. Deadly choices or deadly exposures, each leaving broken young lives in the wreckage. Violence is increasingly a problem of children killing children in this country. And the very nature of today's violence is more apt to be fatal than it was in earlier times. When I was growing up, and I'm sure many of you, and there were fights, whether those fights were on the corner or after basketball or football games, they usually involved fists or rocks. Today, they involve guns and knives, and often guns. Every day, 135,000 students take guns to school in this country. Homicide is the second leading cause of death for people in this country between the ages of 15 and 34, and it's the first leading cause of death among African Americans between the ages of 15 and 34. One out of five deaths of U.S. teens is due to guns, and firearm injuries are responsible for more deaths among U.S. teenagers than all of the natural causes combined. But the interesting thing is, because there's a lot of debate that goes on in the country about is violence getting better, is it getting worse, is it staying the same? And from our perspective at CDC, the issue relates to what's happening among our youth. Since 1985, the risk of dying from firearm injury has increased 77% for teenagers. And that's the group that we're most concerned about, even though it is a general problem. A judge in Detroit recently shared with me some information about a program which he had implemented, and basically what he did was to require every young person who came into his court because of using a gun to take a class before that young person could be bailed. And one of the questions that he asked people before they could be bailed was, why do you carry a gun? And 90% of the time the answer was, I carry a gun because I'm afraid not to, because there's so many people out there with guns. The nation is at last on its way to addressing the dangers of firearms. Through the passage of progressive legislation such as the Brady Bill and the most recently House-passed ban on assault weapons, our national commitment is becoming clearer. And I believe that the next list of preventions that work will include these measures. And they will translate into many lives saved, many of them young lives. Bill Bradley's speech here last week reminded us all that the solutions are closer to home and closer to community than in Washington, D.C. In 1993, a CDC-funded study was reported by Arthur Kellerman and others. And basically, the study asked the question, what happens when a family buys a gun and bring that gun into the home for protection? And to make a long story short, among other things, that family was three times more likely to have a homicide occurring between members in the family, spouse versus spouse, a child versus child, sometimes accidental deaths, and five times more likely to have a suicide than families that did not have a gun. So the answers, indeed, are not just in Washington. They have a lot to do with community and home. Perhaps less dramatic choices and exposures than those mentioned relate to things like diet and physical activity. We've worked very hard to try to motivate people to eat properly and to exercise regularly. However, today, between the grades of 9 and 12, only 37% of teenagers engage in vigorous physical activity three times a day. And among 12th grade students, as few as 10% eat 5 or more servings of fruits and vegetables as recommended, while 70% of them have at least 2 major meals that are heavily laden with fat each day, 70%. Well, that's the bad news, and I don't like to dwell on bad news, and it was meant to be an introduction because I do believe that there is some real hope in what we can do together as community. If we're willing to make the commitment philosophically and materially to do them. CDC is the nation's prevention agency, and we are responsible to a great extent for helping to develop interventions to help solve problems and prevent them. Prevention is the key, and if that sounds simple, it's not. A wide range of preventive programs and services must be brought to bear on what we have seen as a wide range of problems. Some are already in place and need to be augmented. We need to find others and to try them. First, there's a unique opportunity to prevent or change high-risk behavior in young people afforded in our nation's schools. Every day, we have 46 million students in over 100 million schools in this country, in 100,000 schools in 15,000 school districts. Given the size and accessibility of this population, the impact that school health education could make to improve the health of young people, and most importantly, into maturity, is enormous. We know that school health education, when it is planned, sequential education for students that starts in kindergarten and goes through 12th grade, when it is designed to motivate and to enable them to maintain and improve their health, and not merely to prevent disease, we know that it is effective. It addresses a wide range of health issues and problems, showing the relationship of risk behavior to health. It is appropriate to students' age levels and consistent with the values of the community in which they live. It recognizes the realities of peer pressure, and it seeks to provide youth with decision-making, communication, and peer-resistant skills, all of which are designed to accompany them beyond the classroom and to help them practice positive health behavior choices. And it does work. It works. Rigorous, large-scale studies have shown that comprehensive school health education in schools is effective in reducing the prevalence of health risk behaviors. For example, such studies have shown a reduction of almost 40% in the onset of smoking when seventh graders are educated about the risk of smoking, a reduction of 40%. A reduction in drug use and alcohol consumption has been demonstrated to follow education in the schools. And sex education, which is so hotly debated, has resulted in a significant decrease in risky sexual behavior. In fact, sex education in the schools has now been demonstrated by studies in this country and the World Health Organization to decrease the risk of young people beginning sexual activity before they reach the 12th grade, but also to significantly decrease risky sexual behavior among those that are sexually active. That has been clearly demonstrated now in several studies. Finally, comprehensive school health education is not only good sense, it is also good dollars and cents. Preliminary studies indicate that for every dollar that we spend on tobacco education, drug and alcohol education, and sexuality education, we actually save $14 in avoided health care costs. And that's up there near what we experience with immunizations, where the savings can be as high as $20 to $30 for every dollar invested. And other prevention measures are already proven to be or are projected to be cost effective. For every dollar spent on publicly financed contraceptive services, almost $5 is saved on medical services, welfare, and nutrition. So it makes good dollars and cents. Bicycle helmets save lives and save dollars. Numerous studies have also found that for every 10% increase in the price of cigarettes, there will be a corresponding 4% reduction in consumption. Now, what this means is that the proposed 75-cent increase in tobacco will result in about a 40% increase in the price, and that will result in a 12% reduction in cigarette consumption. It is estimated that this 75-cent tax increase will ultimately save nearly 1 million lives. While the health and well-being of our youth constitutes a major responsibility of the public health community and the school program, they cannot do it alone. Each of the problems confronting our young people is a societal problem as well. Because behavioral changes face a battery of societal pressures from peers, from the world of advertising, from those who would profit by continuance of harmful behavior, and even from the high energy level and quantity of leisure time enjoyed by today's youth themselves. You know, in order to keep teenagers busy, adults have to be willing to work with teenagers. But then the question, where is our community? At no place do we see more clearly the societal impact on our youth's behavior choices than when we contemplate, again, the frightening choice of violence. It is vital that we realize that marked economic and social disparities among Americans contribute to the ideology of violence in fundamental ways. Poverty, joblessness, and a lack of real employment opportunities promote violence by generating a sense of frustration, low self-esteem, and hopelessness about the future. When I was president at Meharry, I remember initiating a program with the support of the Carnegie Foundation to look at teenage pregnancy in the housing projects. But when our people, clinical psychologists and social workers, went to the housing projects and interviewed teenagers and their parents, what they found was that teenage pregnancy was not the problem. It was just like violence and substance abuse and early school dropout. It was a symptom of the attitudes of young people about the future. So they decided to call the program, I Have a Future. And all of the effort, therefore, went into changing the attitude of teenagers toward the future. And that's what America faces today, a real challenge to convince teenagers that there's hope for them in the future. Racism also contributes to violence, both directly through the anger caused by racial discrimination and indirectly by depriving certain segments of society of the opportunities to be successful in school and work. The poor in society, who are disproportionately African American, Hispanic, and Native American, do not have equal access to our criminal justice, educational, and healthcare system. The tendency in this society is to equate individual attainment with self-worth without regards for equal opportunity, contributing to the frustration and anger associated with violence. But the challenge really is for all of us, whether we talk about racism, sexism, anti-Semitism, the real question is, what about those of us who do not share those beliefs? What are we doing? Are we developing positive relationships which teenagers can see? Or are we sending teenagers to schools to integrate them when they see no integrated activity among their parents and their communities? Where is the community? If we are to prevent death and injuries from interpersonal violence, society must address these fundamental issues, and society must be willing to invest in their solution. We must also engage in a vigorous program of marketing healthy behavior choices to combat the equally vigorous marketing of unhealthy behaviors such as violence on TV and appealing cigarette ads. And it can be done. There's no more compelling example than what's happened in this country since 1964 with smoking. The number of people who have ceased smoking, or the number of people who did not begin because of marketing against smoking. This long battle, which started in 1964, has had a tremendous impact on our society. Now, there are no vaccines to make young people wear seat belts or to refrain from smoking or to avoid unsafe sexual practices. We are learning that if we engage the attention and participation of the total community and its institutions, that is, the churches, the academic community, the neighborhood block associations, the trade and professional organizations, sports and entertainment figures. Together, we can better protect our children from deadly choices and exposures. Our proven programs can be strengthened, and out of community commitment, new ideas will germinate. Well, let me close by sharing with you one of my favorite quotes, because sometimes it is true that the problems we face can become overwhelming. And I often think about a quote from one of my favorite people, Dr. Benjamin Elijah Mays, who would have been 100 years old if he had lived. He was president of Morehouse for 27 years and one of the most outstanding educators in the history of this country. But one of his favorite quotes was that it must be borne in mind that the great tragedy of life is not in failing to reach your goal. It is in having no goal for which you're reaching. It is not a calamity to die with dreams unfulfilled, but it is a calamity not to dream. It's not a disgrace to fail to reach the stars, but it is a disgrace to have no stars for which you're reaching. It's not a disaster to fail to capture your highest ideals, but it's a disaster to have no ideas for which you're striving. Not failure, but low aim is sin. As a nation, let us not be guilty of low aim when it comes to our youth. Thank you.
First question, you spoke a lot about the problems with smoking. Should we prohibit all advertising of tobacco products?
Well, I don't think the answer to this problem is in a restraint of trade. I think our nation values several things, and some of the freedoms we value are important, and we don't have to engage in trade-offs. I think what we need to do is to more aggressively educate our teenagers. I think the results show very clearly that if we do it aggressively, if we take advantage of the opportunities for school health education, we can help help our young people to make the right choices. So in this case, I don't think it's regulation. Obviously, I think it's appropriate to prohibit the sale or marketing of tobacco to teenagers. The problem we're having is enforcing those laws that we already have. As I pointed out with the Harlem Hospital study, where more than 80% of the teenagers were able to go out into the community and buy cigarettes, both in the pack or looses, as they call them. So the major challenge we face, I think, is enforcement of some of the regulations we already have.
Many parents don't want schools teaching sex education, but they don't take the responsibility either. How can we change that?
Well, we're trying to help to change that, and that's why we have been trying to evaluate very carefully at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention the outcome of some of our sex education. There are people in this country who actually believe that sex education increases sexual activity among teenagers. The scientific studies do not support that. It's just the opposite. Sex education changes the perspective of teenagers towards sex. They get the information they need as opposed to information they would otherwise get on the street corner. And all of the results that we have looked at would suggest that not only are you decreasing sexual activity in teenagers, but you're also significantly decreasing the most risky forms of sexual behavior.
How can doctors do a better job of getting teenagers and adults to pursue healthy lifestyles when, in general, they are paid for treating disease, not preventing it?
Well, I have to be careful with doctors here. Let me say one thing. I think public health education is a community responsibility, and I do think that doctors are important. As a physician, I take my responsibility very seriously to make sure that I take advantage of every opportunity to communicate to people at all ages what it means to live healthy lives in terms of diet and exercise and the avoidance of toxins. It is important for doctors to speak out because many people have said that it was when their doctors said that they should stop smoking that they got serious about trying. So I think as physicians, if we don't take advantage of the relationship we have with patients, and if we don't use our community leadership responsibility to help discourage risky behavior, then I think we're being negligent.
Now moving on to some agency questions. CDC is committed to helping South Africa develop a plan for redistributing its healthcare resources. to cover the entire population. How do you assess the challenge facing the South African government?
Well, it's very early in our deliberations. We did participate in the World Health Assembly in Geneva recently and had a chance to meet with some of the people from South Africa who were involved with the healthcare system. We also have CDC people working in South Africa. Our assessment to date would be that some of the major challenges relate to infrastructure, the helping to rebuild, or in some cases to build, a public health infrastructure, helping to develop training programs, especially primary care training programs, are things that are going to be important in South Africa. And so we look forward to working with South Africa in these areas. There are a lot of problems, categorical problems, that you can talk about, you know, with AIDS and violence, but I think the real issue is helping to develop a system, a public health infrastructure, and a primary care training system.
To what extent does CDC's expanding role in vaccine and re-emerging disease research involve biomedical research, and does the agency envision work in this area to involve the creation of an extramural research program?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I think it's fair to say that the primary charge of the Centers for Disease and Control is not biomedical research, but biomedical research becomes important in a lot of the things that we do. For example, you remember the hantavirus outbreak in the Southwest. It was really the quality of the laboratories at CDC which resulted in identifying that virus rapidly and saving hundreds of thousands of lives, I'm sure. So biomedical research is important, but the primary role of CDC is more in population-based prevention research, and it is that area where I feel we need to invest many more of our resources. Today, less than 1% of the health expenditures in this country actually go to population-based prevention research or population-based prevention. And I think that's what we need to change, and CDC sees that as its primary mission.
There have been outbreaks of measles in the U.S. recently. Are people refusing to get vaccinated? Why? What can we do to change that?
Well, it's very complicated, and as you know, we're responsible for the National Immunization Program, which President Clinton announced from the White House about 3 weeks ago. And the challenges there are really many. And many of them are the challenges that we're going to face with healthcare reform. The first challenge, obviously, is universal access. I mean, how can we assure that every child has access to vaccine? That's part of the problem. Part of the problem is the whole public-private relationship, the role of physicians, the role of health departments. But there is another challenge which you raise, and that is the responsibility of parents and community when it comes to seeing that children are immunized. There are a lot of the, quote, developing countries in the world that now have much better immunization records than we do because they've had this community leadership. We are beginning to develop that. There are people who have concerns about immunizations, and therefore there has to be a lot of education, public education, but there has also to be a lot of support for parents in their relationship with physicians in terms of seeing that every child is immunized before the age of two. So there's a number of problems that we're dealing with immunization, but I think we're making progress, and we hope that by the year 2000, at least 90% of the children in this country will be immunized by the age of two. That's our goal.
The United States does not have a food policy to encourage healthy consumer food habits, as do some other countries. Would you urge this administration to begin in this direction as one area of disease control, despite the obvious opposition that would come from the food industry?
Well, again, I think that raises again the question about what is really needed to make a difference. I think some of the recent developments in terms of labeling of food represent a step forward. If we follow that with a lot of solid education, especially beginning in the school system, about the appropriate dietary habits and behaviors, I think in time we will see a significant increase in the people in this country who eat properly. There's an issue of motivation, too, especially when it comes to teenagers. And that's why I think it's so critical that the education begins in the school system, where peer relationships are so important. So I think the answer, again, lies in improving our educational program for parents and children at every level.
Now we have several questions on AIDS. Why do you think teenagers aren't more aware of the dangers of AIDS if they are sexually active? Is this just the immortality complex of youth?
Well, I'm not sure we fully understand everything that's going on with teenagers in this country. I'm convinced that it has a lot to do with the attitudes toward life in general and toward the future. It also has a lot to do with what they see taking place in the world today. Some of the things you can see on the screen can be quite discouraging in terms of looking to the future. I think we're seeing some of that despair in the attitude of teenagers in this country. But I also think we're seeing, in many cases, a lack of awareness, a lack of acute awareness in terms of the appropriate behavior. But we're also seeing peer pressure. And again, it gets back to why school-based education is so important, because it deals with the issue of peer pressure and peer relationships. And some of the programs that we have throughout the country dealing with AIDS and with violence really take advantage of these peer relationships and peer leadership and decision-making and communication among teenagers. I think all of those things have to happen. And then I think we have to become a more sensitive country when it comes to presenting to our teenagers some more positive role models of how people should live and work together in the society. I think that's a real challenge that we face. And so I think attitude is a major part of it, but I also think awareness is still important.
A few years ago, there was a lot of fear that AIDS would spread quickly to the general population. How much of a concern is that today?
Well, AIDS is a global problem, and in whatever we do, we have to continue to look at it as a global problem. We estimate that there are probably about 14 to 15 million people in the world who are infected with the AIDS virus today, HIV, and that by the year 2000, if things continue as they're going, that would be 40 million. Or more. So we have to take the attitude that AIDS is a tremendous threat to society. Now, having said that, I should also point out that we have reason to feel that we're making some progress in this country in terms of the spread of AIDS. We believe that the epidemic, based on the last few years, is tapering off. But we think it would be a serious mistake for us to take anything for granted relative to this problem and to let up in any way in terms of our public education, and especially education as it relates to teenagers. One of the interesting things happening with the AIDS epidemic, of course, in this country, is becoming more of a heterosexual problem. Throughout the world, I think it's been a heterosexual problem much longer. But in this country, as we look at the data each year, what we see is more involvement of women. In fact, the fastest growing group of persons in this country diagnosed with AIDS in recent years have been women, HIV positive AIDS. And so it's becoming more heterosexual. And the type of education that we need for our teenagers especially is the heterosexual education. I think to a great extent, the gay community has done a pretty good job of curtailing this problem in some communities. There's still a lot to do. We've got to be more targeted with our programs. But we have some very solid programs throughout the country dealing with this problem.
On the other side of the question, the other side of prevention, have we made any quantum leaps in discovering a cause or a cure or even a therapy for AIDS? What are the trends?
Well, the bad news is that I don't think is that we can say that we're close to developing a vaccine for AIDS. The AIDS virus is certainly one of the most difficult viruses that we've ever encountered, in part because of its unusual ability to change, to mutate. And so I think we're still learning, and we have much more to learn about the AIDS virus. So we're not close to developing a vaccine. I think most people in the research and development of a vaccine would agree with that. And I can't say that we're close to developing a cure, a treatment or a cure. The good news is that this disease is entirely preventable. I mean, we know how it's spread. We know how to prevent the spread of it. And what we need to do is become more diligent in exercising what we know.
A member of our audience here heard you describe the many problems and ways to address them, but this questioner says, not one syllable of your talk about moral training. Why not?
Well, I guess it depends on how you define morality. I think the way people relate to each other is a moral issue. And I do believe that we have a moral responsibility to care about all of the children in this country and to act as a community in caring. I think that's morality at its best. I think when we say to people, if you're not racist, if you're not anti-Semitic, if you're not sexist, it's not enough to criticize people who are. You need to be doing something. You need to be developing positive relationships. You need to be demonstrating how people live and work together who don't have these problems. Too many of the people who say that they are not racist, they're not sexist, they're not anti-Semitic, think it's enough just to say that and to criticize people who are. But I think the real challenge we face in this country in the name of morality is not only to stand up, but to become more active in developing models of positive human relationships. To me, I think that's morality at its best. Thank you.
You discussed the deadly choices and the violence faced by our youth, but what is being done about the psychological impact of living with the constant threat of death and destruction? Are there programs in place to help children deal with that?
That's a good question, and I'm not sure I have the answer. I think there are some developing programs. Last week in Atlanta, I visited a program called Outreach Atlanta, which is one of the most positive programs I have experienced. It's interesting in that the program is really targeted to people who are HIV positive, and many of them former drug abusers. And what this program has done is to bring together a core of such people who are now drug-free, who know that they're HIV positive, but who are spending all of their time working in the community, educating children, talking to people on the streets about how to prevent this disease. I guess when I think back to that experience, I think in two ways. One, how impressed I was with these individuals who know that they're HIV positive and what that means. And the fact that they convinced me that there is, quote, life after HIV. And they view this as one of the best parts, times of their life as they are contributing something to community. The other thing that it said to me, however, was that suppose, in fact, these individuals who had various kinds of problems, including drug addiction, some of them had been to prison, suppose somehow we had gotten to them earlier, and suppose they had not been victims or not become infected with this virus, what contributions they could make perhaps for many more years. I think programs like that, more than anything else, are going to begin to change attitudes and certainly some of the fatalism that we see in our society. But we need more.
Now turning to the enemy, it is us. Does the press have a balanced view affecting health funding, or does it emphasis on one health problem over another lead to unfair funding situations?
Well, it's a tough one. Let me say that I think it's difficult to make decisions about funding, and obviously resources are limited. And I think still there are some areas where there's much more awareness, much more education in society about problems, and those areas tend to be better funded. I think the bottom line of our concern, and I think it should be all of our concern in this country, about how we spend our money relative to health care, is the fact that we spend so much of our money on treating things that could be prevented in the first place, and so little of our money on preventing things. Now, I think the health care reform proposal that is in Congress recognizes that and is an attempt to shift the emphasis to more concern and concentration on prevention. We have a long ways to go. I gave you the figures. I mean, less than 1% of our health expenditures today go for population-based prevention. We have a long ways to go. But I think it means that we have to make sure that people become more aware. We're trying to do that. And that people begin to speak out so that we can prevent a lot of the problems that we're spending a lot of time treating. Often, we spend most of that money in the final 3 months of life, by the way.
This may or may not be within your purview, but this questioner asks, what is the effect of television and film violence on teens and their community? What, if anything, should the government do to reduce TV and film violence?
Well, it's interesting. I was last year when I attended the World Health Assembly in Geneva, I remember being in a session and we were talking about various global health problems, and I remember the representatives from Zimbabwe speaking out and saying that when it comes to violence, that America is a third world country, and that what's happening on our TV and in our films is very negatively affecting their children. I guess what I would say is that we have an opportunity to market positive behavior and anti-violent behavior much more than we have done or are doing. We have demonstrated the ability to do that with smoking. You remember when every lead character had a cigarette in his or her mouth and how rare that is today? We've made a lot of progress. I think we can do the same thing in terms of violent behavior, and we can make nonviolent behavior much more popular with our young people than it is today.
We had several questions about lead poisoning. Is lead poisoning of kids still rising, or is it going down? Why or why not?
Well, it's interesting. Just before coming here, I participated in a conference over at the Sheraton, Washington, on lead poisoning. It's the Alliance for the Prevention of Lead Poisoning in Children. And there are at least three components of CDC and ATSDR that deal with lead poisoning. But let me say this, Dr. Lena Rosenstock is head of the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, and there's a concern in terms of lead poisoning in the workforce. But for children in this country, I think we've made a lot of progress in lead poisoning, primarily because of reducing lead in gasoline and in foods. So we have made significant progress in reducing the number of children, for example, who will have lead levels above 15 micrograms per deciliter. And that's just shop talk, but what it means is that as we measure and become concerned about levels of lead, that's a significant level. We've made a lot of progress. Most of our problems today relate to old housing, housing built before 1980, where there's lead-based paint. And what children, especially in the inner city, are often affected by peeling paint or lead in the dust related to these homes. But yes, we've made a lot of progress.
Well, I have one last question, but before asking it, I'd like to present you with a certificate of appreciation and a National Press Club mug.
Thank you.
Last question. I think we have a slightly disgruntled reporter in the room. We've heard you plan to reorganize the CDC Public Affairs Division. What specific steps do you plan so it doesn't take days or weeks to speak to a person who actually can take a reporter's question, or better still, to answer one? Thank you.
I'm tempted to refer that question to Ann Sims, but I won't.
I know you were feeling it.
Well, yeah, I think we are in the process of reinventing, if you will, CDC. You know, we're reinventing government, and we think it's important to occasionally reinvent ourselves. Well, there are a lot of things that we're looking at in terms of public affairs, and I think the One of the problems, of course, is that we've got to look at staffing in public affairs. But the other thing we're looking at is what we call health communication. And some of the things I talked about in terms of marketing positive behaviors. So we're looking at a program at CDC that really focuses on how do we communicate better about health issues. And I think we're looking at that, but we're also looking at total quality management in everything we do. So whether it has to do with how long it takes us to answer a letter. And by the way, I think we get 5,000 calls a day to some of our programs for information, or how long it takes for us to get back to a reporter. The strategy we have is a total quality management program to improve our responsiveness. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor.
Listening to the Internet Town Hall, a production of the Internet Multicasting Service in association with the National Press Club. You may copy this file and change the encoding format, but may not resell the contents or make a derivative work. Support for the Internet Town Hall comes from Sun Microsystems and O'Reilly & Associates. Additional support is provided by HarperCollins and Persoft. Network connectivity is provided by UUNET Technologies and MFS DataNet. This is Carl Malamud for the Internet Multicasting Service, Town Crier, to the Global Village.